Ok. Welcome back. Lay, where is Lay?
Yeah.
There he is. Please. Lay is the TA for the course. So, you know, he sent a mail about where he could be found. So that's his office hours, Monday and Wednesday. Did I get it right? 3:30 to 4:30. That would be in the lab. So if you don't get access to the lab, then neither would you see the TA nor the computer. So you have to find access to the lab. And then the exception is tomorrow. He basically graciously made himself available to you guys in the morning, 10 to 12, in his office, which is 561 AC, because you know the Monday and Wednesday for this week are already over. Okay. And he also said that you should all send him, should I just circulate like a sheet where they can write their name on the number, or do you want emails from them?
Send an email to me, I can.
Okay, so he suggested that you all are supposed to send him email with your name and the student ID so that he could. Yeah, okay, so he sent a mail, check that, and send him that information so that he can get you the access to the labs as soon as possible. Wayne Woodland did say that he would generally get that done by like Tuesday. That's what he said. So we'll do both ways to make sure that you get the access. Any other comments that you have, Lee? Okay, that's basically it. So you're off the book. I'll have advertisement slides every day. That's Grigory Perlman. Anybody knows why he's there? You should have life other than this course, but you should use that only to figure out these advertisements, nothing more. Who knows? Yes. So yeah, no, we'll doesn't matter. Yeah. Say your name, please.
I'm Kyle.
Okay. Yeah, that's explaining why Pluto is in mourning. Everybody is very sad that they're no longer a planet as of today, as of yesterday. What about this other guy, Grigory Perelman? Will. Yes, so the idea is end of last class we were talking about how there are no Nobel Prizes for mathematicians. I don't know why we were talking about that, it's a computer science class, but we did. And it so happens that in fact Fields Medals were awarded in Madrid. Every 4 years they award Fields Medals, which are called the Nobel Prizes of Mathematics, and so they only give them like 1/10 or 1/100 the money that real Nobel Prizes people get. So about $13,000, which will be enough to go to Madrid, I think. But it's a very prestigious medal, and Grigory Perelman was widely expected to win it as one of the people this year because he has potentially proved one of the long-standing conjectures, the Poincaré conjecture. About topology, which is in topology, which essentially says, you should go and look it up, that any three-dimensional object without holes in it can be shrunk back to a three-dimensional sphere. And this actually is also true for all n dimensions, n greater than 3 too, except it's been proved for n greater than 3 already. N equal to 3 hasn't been proved. This guy proved it. Nobody knows really whether he proved it or not. He put up the papers and he came and gave a couple of lectures and disappeared in Russia. He's from Russia. He's a Russian Jew who doesn't seem to care about popular approbation. So he said, you know, I put up my proofs, you go figure it out. And then he disappeared. And And so when they gave him Fields Medal, he said, I don't want to come, probably because I think it's really costly to go from Russia to Madrid, and 13,000 won't be enough. Anyway, that's those two. Actually, if you look at CNN, there is an article on that, but everybody is talking about this. Okay. Questions? Any questions on anything that we talked about last time? Nothing? Okay. There were a bunch of things that were done to the class list since last time. The mail archive continues to exist, if I can get there. Yeah, there you go. And there is a blog, and a bunch of people actually, everybody in the class is allowed to post and comment on the articles on the blog, so we can talk about anything else of interest to you about AI, hopefully. So a lot of people have already apparently signed in, so you can use this. I sent some mail about a reasonable way to use the blog versus the mail list, which simplified to its bare essentials says, I get to send mail to you, you only get to post on the blog. Okay. That's so that if there's too much mail, people will just stop reading my mail. And so we can write general things about AI and so on that you want to talk about on the blog. Okay. I did look at the survey sheets. There are a couple of things. Reasons for taking course, most people said it sounded interesting, that it will be of use in their research, which is really nice. And examples for the research suggested include AI and biology and AI and games, some other things too. One person said the reason for taking the course is that he or she has been told that it's a straight and easy A. And I really think that kind of bright-eyed and bushy-tailed optimism is what we need in the class. Then the topic suggested neural networks. It somehow seems to be the perennial favorite, and machine learning, which is like much bigger topic, but we'll definitely do machine learning. We will talk about neural networks. Some people said genetic algorithms, we'll talk about them, connect them up to hill climbing algorithms, hill climbing search at some point of time. Some people mentioned multi-agent systems, multi-agent learning, not likely to get there, okay, but we will try. Some people have mentioned perception and robotics. Despite all the great shows about robot soccer and cars driving unattended, I don't think we'll get too much into perception and robotics in this class. Partly because the background you would need to do perception involves some sophistication in signal processing sorts of stuff. It's important stuff, but I won't do it. Okay. Couple of other things. Recitation session, 19 people said they would be very interested in a recitation session held weekly. 21 people said they might have some interest and others didn't care. So this sort of means that there are enough people who want a recitation session, will try to look for making it happen. Probably one of the, either the TAs or either the TA or one of the other another ATS might hold this. I have people who want to do this. Okay, so we'll find a time for that. Any other questions that you might have that I didn't bring up? Okay. Okay, so course overview. I showed this slide last time and said, oh, I won't go into it right now, and I'll show it once again and say, I won't go into it right now. So that's the course overview, but we will get to it in a minute. So if you have no more questions at all about last time, I want to talk about architectures for intelligent agents. Because last time we ended by saying that you can think of the enterprise of AI as having one of four different goals. And we basically pointed out that all of them sort of make sense, but we would like to spend more time. I mean, basically, we'd like to give our work to design of rational agents, or agents that act rationally as against agents that think rationally, are agents that act like humans, are agents that think like humans. Okay. Now, I do want to mention that it's not the case that other definitions are completely bogus, and nor is it the case that people thinking of AI in that way haven't made contributions to AI. In fact, we spent a lot of time last class trying to say that, in fact, those other definitions do make sense. Okay. Except, I think the idea of designing rational agents sort of makes more sense than the other three definitions. Now, there are specific areas which correspond more closely to each of those other definitions. So, for example, if what you're interested in doing is designing agents that think like humans, then the whole area of cognitive psychology, cognitive neuroscience, etc., make a lot of sense. Okay. So the way to think of them is cognitive psychology, cognitive neuroscience has overlap with what AI does, but it's not exactly one and the same. Okay, so these are all connected, but they're not one and the same. Okay. So we ended by saying we're going to look at rational agent design, or basically we're trying to design agents that act rationally. So we're going to talk a little bit about what these agents might look like, how do we define rationality, what would be the general kinds of architecture for these agents. To put this all in perspective, if last class was at stratospheric level, this class is, you know, of 1,000 feet below it. Okay, and next class we will be very much close to the ground level. So there is going to be a huge change in the abstraction from this class to the next class. So today would be, we would be taking a broader view of, you know, what are the important issues in designing intelligent agents. And then starting next class, we'll be talking about specifics, very, you know, more narrower pieces of this. Okay. How many of you have read chapter 2? The rest of you should be very unhappy about yourself. what else can I say? You should read chapter 2 if you haven't already read so, done so. In many ways, that chapter and this lecture are frustrating, because if you don't understand what are the bigger points, you would have a hard time figuring out, why am I doing planning? Why am I doing search? Why am I doing something else? But at the same time, chapter 2 is quite a deep chapter. In fact, I could spend several weeks talking about just chapter 2. I'll only spend one class. Okay. Much of what will happen is, at the end of the semester, you should go back and read chapter 2. Okay. And you will know much more. You will appreciate it much more. But at the same time, you should read it once now, so that you have a feel for, why do we need knowledge representation? Why do we need planning? Why do we need learning? Why do we need perception? Why are these things parts of AI and not other things part of AI? Okay. So here is where we sort of make like sort of a declaration of the manifesto. And you could question the manifesto, but if you want, this is the place to question it. But once you kind of agree with the manifesto, then certain things fall, you know, pretty rationally through. Okay. So having said that, normally at the end of the semester when I ask people, so, you know, list me topics that you liked, or list me topics that you hated, this lecture winds up being listed in both. Okay. It's in some people's the best possible topic to talk about, and in some other people's, my God, we had no clue why we are doing discussion at a high level. So I'm aware of it. Okay. However, I still think you should do this. You should understand what is the general lay of the architectures for intelligent agents. Okay. And then we'll go into detail starting next week. Okay. So an agent, what's an agent? It looks cute like this, and it has an environment in which it is acting, and from the environment, it gets sensory information. So if it has some sensors, then it can sense the state of the environment, and it can affect the environment by doing things in the environment. Okay, at the very highest level, that's all an agent does. So an agent essentially can be specified by specifying what sorts of sensory information can it handle, what sorts of effectors does it have, what changes can it do to the environment, and what is the kind of environment it has. Okay. Furthermore, of course, now there is this bigger issue of what do you want to do. Yeah, this is true that you are getting sensing information and you are affecting the environment, but why even bother? I mean, presumably you bother because you have something that the agent has some goals that it wants to achieve. Okay. Those are the four things that we'll wind up talking about when describing agents. And so it's like percepts, actions, goals, environment. Okay. Now, I made my agent look extremely cute and it looks like humans with some wheels. But really, your agent can be a black box. It doesn't really matter. We're going to write software artifacts which, you know, which can look like a big box. All it's doing is here, there is sensory information coming in. Here, there is effectors. You know, it's affecting the environment. All we want to figure out really is what's in this box. If what's in the box is a human, of course, we are going back to the mechanical Turk idea for AI. Okay, but what we want to figure out is what should go into that box such that it would be able to, you know, basically do useful things to achieve its goal. So there are two parts to this class. One first is, the bigger part of course is what should go into the box. Think of this as a box and what should go into the box. Okay, but to even understand what should go into the box, you should understand what sort of sensing is possible in different types of environment. What sort of affecting is possible, what are the kinds of environments, what are the kinds of goals an agent might have. Okay, now, I hate the word agent. Okay, and if you really, really like the word agent, that's because, I don't know, I think you're just letting me get away with it. Okay, one of the points we're trying to make is to demystify the word agent. You know, it can be pretty much any software entity, any entity, okay, which can take some sensory information and affect its environment. And in doing so, it's trying to achieve some goals. Okay? To give an idea of the spectrum, suppose I'm considering a taxi driving agent. Okay, so for example, the one that just won the DARPA Grand Challenge, Stanley. Okay, so Stanley is an agent. It went around Las Vegas desert and, you know, came faster than some of the other people, some other cars. So how would we go about characterizing Stanley in terms of its perceptions, its actions, its goals, and its environment? Okay, so for example, it has some information about perception in terms of sensory information. It has video, it could have. I don't know about Stanley specifically. In fact, I do know, but you can find out exactly the sensory information Stanley uses by following the link I gave you to Sebastian Thrun's talk on Google Video. But, you know, something that if you are trying to design this, right, you would realize that you might use video, you might use accelerometers, you know, which tells you how fast you're going, how slow you're going, various types of gauges, some engine sensors, and so on. Okay, I'm not particularly sure why you would need a keyboard. I think the keyboard is needed here because this was meant for a taxi driving agent. Okay, so this is the urban challenge, which hasn't yet been solved. You know, this is the one that we're going to solve next year. Okay, what was interesting is this slide was made by Stuart Russell 5 years back when he thought this is a pipe dream. So it would be worth talking about pipe dreams in the beginning of the class. But now it's no longer a pipe dream. It's coming closer to reality. Okay, so I should find out something even more blue sky. But that's okay. One of the interesting things is, talking about Stanley, it uses video almost as an afterthought. It tries to do most of its sensing by laser range finding. Okay, and you should listen to the talk. It's interesting. They essentially wind up combining the vision sensing with the laser range finding sensing to get an overall view of where they're going. It turns out you would think that the most obvious thing to do is to use vision to do driving because that's what you do. But you know, I mean, the most obvious thing to do flying is to flap wings, and I haven't seen any planes doing it of late. Okay, So the actions, the kinds of actions might be steering, accelerating, braking, horn, speed, display, etc. And one of these actions might fail and you lose the challenge. That's exactly what happened to CMU's agent, right? I mean, if they had a nice little stone that they could put on the accelerator, you know, it would have won the competition. Again, I'm assuming that some of you are aware of what happened in the DARPA Grand Challenge, where CMU had two entries and one entry was ahead of the game for the longest time, and then there's this beautiful place where it sort of, there's a slight gentle slope, and this is a Humvee, okay? So normally Humvees can just flatten the slopes, and this thing kind of tries to go up and slides down. It's almost like hit the accelerator, but you know, I guess whatever is the actuator that is pushing the accelerator didn't work or something. So either way, they lost. Yes, sir. That's a very interesting point. That's a very interesting point. That actually connects to autonomy. So since you brought this up, so there is this, again, in digression. CMU spent tons and tons and tons of time making robotic vehicles. Sebastian Thrun was a professor in CMU, and he worked with Red Whittaker, who actually wound up winning the thing. And so Red Whittaker, whose group put the other two, Highlander and whatever the other one is. Okay, so if there is some justice in the world, you would like to see Red Whittaker win, I think. Okay, but on the other hand, many AI people find themselves pretty darn happy that Stanley won, because if Red Whittaker's team won, as you said, the way they actually won, I mean, their strategy was to map the heck out of the entire 143 miles and specifically tell the car exactly what to do to go from point 1 to point 2 to point 3 to point 4, point 5. Now, if these things have to become intelligent, you know, driverless vehicles for you and me, then you don't expect Red Whittaker to come and do it for each of the trips you want to take for your friend's home. So the autonomy was somewhat on the less lower side, okay? But they could have won. If they won, that would have been the winner. And it so happened that because of this little mishap, it has nothing to do with that calculation, okay? Which nobody, even now, it's not very clear exactly why it did not, why it started sliding. And because of that, Stanley won, and Stanley gets to say at least that they did not put everything in. So they actually tried to make their decision autonomously. Now, because they did, I get to now stand in front of you and say AI rules. But if they lost, I would have said something else. I wouldn't have actually mentioned DARPA Grand Challenge and mentioned something else. In fact, the cutest vehicle that my son likes and pretty much everybody's little kids would like is this motorcycle, okay, which is the cutest thing. I mean, that thing can fall down and it has a little leg that comes out. It makes itself right and goes on, you know. But it failed, you know. In fact, the first year, he forgot to switch the stabilizer on. So he pushed it, it fell down. That was the end of the first year. The second year, it doesn't have enough perception. He spent all his time, this guy is a Berkeley graduate student, a single graduate student, okay? So it's kind of interesting. So Carnegie Mellon, the huge company involved, I mean, essentially a whole large group of people, this Berkeley entry was just one single graduate student. Who essentially concentrated on bipedal, so two-wheeler locomotion, which is much harder kinematically, because cars at least don't fall. Okay, they have four wheels. Just making a two-wheel thing, you know, stay stable is much harder. So he, all his time went into that. He didn't do too much about perception, et cetera, et cetera. So if you fail on any of these, so the Berkeley guy failed because he didn't have good perception. The CMU guys ultimately failed because they didn't have good actions. I mean, the effectors failed. Now, any small thing fails, the overall goal, the overall result would be a catastrophe and people get to make fun of you. Okay, but to make the whole thing work, you know, we're trying to figure out what all the pieces are needed. Okay, so then goals for these kinds of things, I mean, if it's a taxi driver, I guess, safety, reach destination, maximize profits, obey laws, I don't know, this cannot be a taxi driver. Passenger comfort, my God, anyway, so these are some of the goals that taxi driver agents can have. And now what is the environment? For taxi drivers, it would be urban streets, freeways, traffic, pedestrians, weather, customers, all these things are parts of the environment. And for, of course, the, so this is more like the urban challenge aspect. If it was the grand challenge that just got done, and that was like winding roads and precipitous drops on one side, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. Now, that, you know, if you go to a grade school and you want to get them to get into AI, you use that as an example, right? The second example I'm talking about is internet shopping agent. It's really hard to get people excited about doing that when they're in grade school, okay? At some point of time, I'll tell you how my son wouldn't let me talk to his friend because for some reason he thought I actually do robotics and then found that I don't. And then he was worried that when I talk to his friends, it'll all come out and there'll be a major disaster, socially speaking. So the fact that I'm not doing robotics, I pay for it pretty dearly. But let's see another agent which is so far away from driving, you know, internet shopping, you know. So you have something which is looking at various sites and figuring out which has the cheapest price on something and buy it for you. You know, so this agent is going to be your purchasing agent. Okay. So it turns out that these things are general enough that you can talk about purpose, actions, goals, and environment for internet shopping agent too. The reason I put these things together is because I don't want you to think that AI just means one type of application, for example, let's say robotic driving. So in this case, for example, percepts could be partial contents of sources as found by the get command of various types. Actions can be things like get, post, buy, etc. Now these could be abstract actions where buy essentially involves another set of actions, you know, giving your, you know, credit card, giving the extra 3 digits and all that stuff. The goals could be potentially cheapest price on specific goods, and environment could be internet, and dealing with things like the fact that there is congestion on the internet, and there may be multiple sources on the internet for the things that are trying to sell you, et cetera, et cetera. So this and the other one look worlds apart, but I want you to understand that in terms of perception, actions, goals, environment, you can talk about they sense the environment, they do actions to the environment. In doing this, they're thinking in terms of some goals. And of course, the environment itself has different kinds of properties. Okay. In fact, we'll spend a lot of time talking about properties of each of them, especially of the environment. As those of you who read the chapter know, that environment properties do matter a lot in terms of whether you can do these designs. So, agents can be thought of from the input-output perspective in terms of percepts. Actions, goals, environment characteristics. Okay? And then, in terms of what they want to achieve, I kind of said goals, but you could talk about a more general point of view, which is, in a sense, how do you decide the agent is doing well, this program is doing well? There is some performance measure over which you are seeing how well it is doing. Now, it turns out that you think, in most cases, you'd say, yeah, there'll be a performance measure, I'll just go with it. But I'll spend at least a few minutes here, and then you should read the textbook which goes into what looks like conniption fits trying to explain why the idea of defining a performance metric, which is externally defined, is very, very important. Because every once in a while, somebody would come up with a great idea for writing some program where they wind up deciding the performance, the agent winds up deciding its own performance metric. We humans, try to do that. You know, if we are trying to reach something and we don't reach it, they say, I actually wasn't really planning on reaching that anyway. And so we have terms for this, right, like sour grapes and all that stuff, right? So the important thing is, A, there should be a performance metric that's defined outside of the agent, okay, and B, so how are you actually, with respect to that performance metric, how are you deciding whether the agent has done well or not? Okay, so now, if there is a performance metric, with respect to the high-level description of agents that we have talked about, how would you specify such a performance metric? These are fairly abstract things we are talking about. Again, as I said, we'll hear it today, And if you survive the entire semester, you go back and read this chapter again at the end, and it makes a lot more sense. But it should make some sense at least now, because this is your manifesto to some extent. So it turns out that performance metrics ultimately have to depend upon the states through which the environment progressed as the agent is acting on it. Okay. So ultimately, the environment, current state of the environment, let's say, can be, you could talk about the current state of the environment, S1, and then you do some action, it becomes S2, another action, S3. Now, the states can be continuously changing, but for now we'll think in terms of discrete changes of states. Okay. So for an outsider who is looking at this environment, all they see, that an outsider, not this guy, but somebody else like us, we see that this environment is going through a sequence of states. Now, when my red agent is doing this task, this environment went through state S1, S2, S3, etc., up to S100, let's say. And then your blue agent did it. It went through S1 dash, S2 dash, etc., up to S100 dash. The question is, how is my red agent better or worse than your blue agent? And the argument is that ultimately, the only thing that you can actually compute, you know, the external observer can compute, is a function over the state that the environment has gone through. Okay? So some function over the sequence of states that the environment has gone through. Now, let's try to understand the generality of this. Suppose actually what I wanted is the environment to get to a very specific state. So for example, I wanted the chair here to be pushed to that particular corner. Okay? So I, you know, red agent goes through a bunch of states. In the beginning, the chair is here, then it is on the top of this table, and then on top of the other guy's head, and then finally went to the corner. And the blue agent does some number of other states, goes to the corner. Now, in this kind of a scenario, the performance only depends upon the final state that has been exhibited. So if all I care about is whether the chair has reached the corner or not, I, the third party, then I would just say your performance over a sequence of states, S1 to Sn, is a function really of the last state, Sn. And in particular, I would check whether in Sn the chair is in the corner. If so, you get full points. If not, you don't get any points. Now, suppose both red and blue agents actually got the chair there, and the red agent actually, you know, went around the room and put the chair there. Blue agent walked over people's heads with the chair, and they were, you know, not very happy. Okay, if you look only at the final state, they're equally good. But the outside party can decide and say, look, it's not just enough to reach the corner, but I also want to make sure that each state that you have gone through has certain properties, such as people are not crying in abject pain. Okay? So when you start doing that, you now realize that actually it's not just the last state, it is the entire sequence of states. Okay? So in general, the point I'm trying to make is a performance metric depends on any performance metric you can think of, and in fact this is sort of a challenge and you can try to do this, any performance metric that you can think of as an outsider to the agent would have to depend upon the sequence of states that the environment has exhibited. Okay, it doesn't have to give equal weight to all states. It's just a function of the entire sequence. It might depend on the middle state. It might depend on all states equally. It might depend on just on the last state. Okay? Yes? As long as you don't decide it, it's good enough. So again, the question is, now you and I might have to decide what is the best chair lifting agent. Or for example, you and I might want to decide what is the best urban car driving agent supposed to do. Okay, so for example, you know, if you don't like my chair example, you know, once this urban challenge comes, the DARPA is saying, you know, you have to go from place X to place Y. That's important. So you do have to go to place Y, but then you don't want to go over people's legs or, you know, or other parts of their body. You shouldn't go too close to people. So they decide this upfront. If DARPA said, hey, we don't really care. You know, all we want is to go from place A to place B. The right way to win the competition is get a nice big-sized Humvee and mow the people down, okay, and get to where you want to go. So the answer to your question is somebody, whoever has designed, so somebody has a problem for which you designed your agent to solve that problem. They have requirements. That's, it's their job to tell you what they want. Exactly. All I want to say is the guy who designs the agent better not also decide what the agent is supposed to do. Because then, you know, we will say whatever we did is exactly what we were trying to do. Okay? So again, this, you know, it's a small formula here, but it may or may not have been obvious to you guys that ultimately your performance depends on the sequence of states. Can anybody tell me a proverb that you may have heard? Like, now, honesty is the best policy that we heard last time, right? I mean, so tell me a proverb, a common saying that captures this point that performance is not just the last state. All that ends that ends well is exactly only thing that matters is the final thing. Yes, journey matters more than destination. I mean, normally we tend to think of this as being said by the losers who actually didn't reach their destination, but really it does. You know, in fact, when you have the proverb which says journey matters as much as the destination, that's actually about the sequence of states that you went through. Yes, sir. Ends don't justify the means is not, it doesn't, yeah, kind of related. But I like the journey matters. And journey is important too, which means it's not just the final state, it's the way you get to the final state. So you get to actually say, you know, drive through nice looking areas, you know, the scenic route as against, and then stop to smell the roses and all that fun stuff. Yes, sir. This is not business school. Customer is never right. I don't know. I'm not sure. Does anybody think customer is always right? I mean, not philosophical objections, but... Okay. So anyway, so performance is a function of history. Now, here's the other question. If I have two agents, right, for doing some task, and in... One, no, so exactly what are we capturing? Is it their performance on a single task or their expected performance? Okay, so we are actually saying in this case that, I mean, I'm saying here that I'm not just interested in the absolute performance on a single trial because that cannot really be optimized, but you have to, when you're designing the agent, you're trying to optimize the expected performance. And in fact, all your proverbs capture the expected performance. Honesty is the best policy. I can tell you a specific instance where you would have been better off not being honest. Okay? To the extent honesty is the best policy, it better be the case that after many times you get to make the decision, should I be honest, not honest, should I be honest, not honest. If you kept doing honest thing, supposedly somebody will, I mean, you will, your performance metric, your expected performance will improve. And of course, you know, people who make up these proverbs always throw in an extra performance metric thing saying heaven awaits you, which doesn't really exist, and you know, that's a different story. But the point is, we talk about expected performance, not the performance on a single, training, single instance. It's important to make the differentiation. So you could have, so for example, suppose it so happened that, in fact, Highlander won and Stanley lost, would that have then meant that the way Stanley was designed is completely wrong? No. On one particular competition, it happened this way, but, you know, you want to actually talk about what is the expected performance of Stanley. Okay? So at the time of design, all you're trying to optimize is this, which is hard, but that's what you're trying to optimize. Okay. Now, so the rational action, an agent which tries to do rational action is trying to do that action which maximizes its expected performance. Okay? I don't know how to do this yet, but this is what my goal is. I want to design agents which do actions that maximize their expected performance. Okay? Now, here's my question. Are there any more qualifications to the definition? And I did write a couple more qualifications. qualification one is with respect to the percept sequence that the agent got. The qualification two, with respect to the prior knowledge that the agent got about the problem. Now, why is this important? Why it is important is it's a lot of fun seeing people like me run into walls. Right? If I run into a wall, you laugh. Okay? I'll get a blind person into the room and he or she, who doesn't have her or his stick and walking dog, keeps running into walls, let's say. Is it fun? Some of you think it's funny, but most of us don't think it's funny. Okay? Why isn't it funny? Because it's funny for me who has eyesight, supposedly, but somehow not using it and running into walls. It's not funny for the other guys because they don't have the same percept sequence that I have. With respect to the percept sequence they have, are they doing the optimal thing? That's ultimately the question. That is ultimately the question. Okay? So now suppose I have eyes and I close my eyes and keep running into things. That's still funny, I think. You know, that's because I'm being foolish and I have my sensory organs and I'm not using it. So it's actually interesting that, you know, some people have said in that, you know, blind people have it easy. People don't expect too much, you know, in terms of not running into things up there. Well, it's not really the case because, so the idea is, so if that is true and if that's the way we define rationality, then all the people who have eyes can close their eyes and be judged, you know, on more lax performance metrics. But we don't buy that. We buy essentially that with respect to the perception capabilities you have, you would be judged. And also, finally, with respect to the prior knowledge you have, you'll be judged. So, for example, I am crossing this road, right, and I used my eyes. I realized that there is no 18-wheeler barreling towards me, and you are there. I wanted to say hello to you and come and shake your hand. I crossed the road. As I'm crossing the road, as the textbook says, this nice example, you know, a huge package fell out of Southwest flight going on top of me, and it came and, you know, knocked me down completely. Now, the question is, would my obituary read, idiot tries to cross the road? Would it mean, would it just say, accident happened to an otherwise reasonable guy? You know? If somebody told me that at 2:30, Southwest plans to drop boxes around this area, and it's like there in state press, and I'm reading the state press while I'm walking, then you would write, idiot tried to cross the road, you know, instead of looking at the road or something. Do you understand what I'm saying? Again, what are we trying to say here? Prior knowledge matters in judging the agent's performance. Okay, so that's why we define rationality in terms of whichever action maximizes the expected value of the performance measures given the percept sequence to date and the prior knowledge. And the convolutions that I went to in describing this one slide is meant to try to explain to you that rational agents are not omniscient. They don't have to be omniscient. You know, they don't have to know everything about the world. And they don't also have to be omnipotent. They don't have to be able to change all possible things in the environment. With respect to what you can change and what your sensing abilities are, your rationality would be determined. And rational doesn't necessarily mean successful on a single episode. It only means expected success. Okay? And then finally, I also said rational doesn't mean intentionally avoiding sensing. You can't become rational by just shutting down all your sensors, unless there is another reason as to why you're doing it. Sometimes maybe the sensors are ruining your battery and you need to preserve the battery to survive something. Okay? So, all we did till now is what are the inputs and outputs for the agent and how would it be judged? And it would be judged in terms of rationality. Again, this is reasonably abstract discussion. Okay, now what we're going to talk about is the properties of the environment. Okay, I did say that matters, and so I'm going to talk a little bit about that. So what kinds of things can affect, what kind of properties can we talk about in the environment without even talking about the application? I won't say internet shopping agent. I won't say taxi agent. Instead, I will talk about general properties of environment. Okay? It's interesting that we can actually do that. Because then we can say, when you go to a new problem, you can say, in this problem, is the environment have property P1, P2, P3, etc.? the properties we're going to look at are, for example, and these things make sense. So one question is, is the environment static or dynamic? That means when I'm not doing anything in the environment, does the environment change its state? Static means when you don't do anything, the environment stays put, waiting for you to do something. Dynamic means it just continues evolving in its own way, and when you do an action, you just modulate the way it evolves. What are the harder problems, the static ones or the dynamic ones? Dynamic ones. Which are the more likely problems you will come across, static or dynamic? Dynamic, which is the one that we will talk about for most of the beginning parts of the course at least. Static, that's easier to solve. It turns out that it is pretty darn hard to solve still, but we should know the difference, static versus dynamic. Now, Microsoft doesn't like me. Oh, not that. Setup show. Okay. So that's the static versus dynamic part. Now, there are two other things, perfect, imperfect, sensing, observable, partially observable. Both of them I would talk about in terms of accessibility of the environment. That means, remember I said, environment goes through states, right? Now, does the agent know the state, the current state of the environment? Does the agent know the current state of the environment? That's like asking, what? Yes, so it depends essentially on whether it senses, really. And in fact, normally, so accessibility really, it turns out, is a function both of the environment and the agent's sensor. Would you agree? Because the same environment can be accessible to one person, one agent, and not to another agent. We talk about this all the time, universal access. You know, currently, all you guys can do typing on the computers, read email, etc., and people who are blind don't have the same access. It's not that the computers have changed, it's their sensory potential that has changed. To make it accessible for them, in essence, you have to do something more. You have to give what you are getting free because of your senses. So I kind of shifted the overall accessibility of the environment from observable, partially observable. That means if an environment actually is inaccessible, that means nobody exists. There are no sensors which actually could have given you the full state. There are also cases where the environment is actually accessible in a theoretical sense if you have the best sensors, but you don't have the best sensors. Okay, so it's sort of interesting, it's useful to think in terms of perfect versus imperfect sensing and observable versus partially observable environment. But both of them together make an environment accessible or inaccessible or partially accessible. Okay, which is the easy problem. Accessible or inaccessible or partially accessible environment. Huh? What? Say it loud, guys. Accessible is easy, yes. What's the hard one? Inaccessible or partially accessible? Whoever said partially accessible, pat yourself on the back. You know, it's actually very important. You know, in some cases, inaccessible is easier because you're not expected to do any better in that scenario. Okay? It turns out we will talk about, in general, this is a much bigger thing than just this particular concept. It turns out that the hardest problems, remember when you were kids, you may have read this, Neil Sendang's book called Wild Things Live. In computer science, we are interested in where hard problems live. Okay? And the hard problems live typically in the middle of interesting kinds of spectrum, not one end or the other. It turns out that in one end, you can solve the problem by just blandly declaring it can't be solved and you'll be right. And in another end, you can solve the problem by actually easily solving it and you'll be right. It's in the middle where if you just toss a coin, you are likely to be wrong most of the time. So you want to stop tossing the coin and actually try to do it. That's where it becomes harder. Okay, so in fact we'll look at interesting kinds of, so we look at this kind of phenomenon later too, but hard problems generally live in the middle in certain spectrums, and in particular for observability, partially observable problems can be harder than inaccessible environments. Okay, about dynamic, it turns out that I said static versus dynamic. Could we differentiate different notions of dynamism in the environment? I know I went back once, but. So static means it doesn't do anything unless I do something to it. Dynamic means even when I'm not doing anything, the environment is changing. Now, of the different dynamic environments, can we still differentiate among them? So for example, if there are only two people in this room, okay, and one of them is me, one of them is you, and if I'm not doing anything, the environment can still change. That's because you're doing something probably. But I know you, let's say. I know a lot about you. Then in some sense, it's dynamic, but it's sort of a multi-agent scenario where I can have a model not just of myself, but also of you. And then start saying, well, something fell with a dull thud. I didn't drop anything. My friend, he sits on a couch, doesn't move. And so, you know, there has to be a different explanation as to why this observation was made. Okay? So in such kind of scenarios, we're talking about multi-agent situation. Dynamic also could mean I don't even have a model of the other agent. I just have, you know, things change without me. I'm not doing it. I don't know who is doing it, but it's changing anyway. Okay, so it turns out that just as you have observability, partial observability, and full non-observability, you also have static, multi-agent, dynamic. Could think of it that way. And once again, the harder problems live in the multi-agent because writing the programs that would do well in multi-agent domains would involve actually modeling the other agents. You can't just say, oh, I don't care about other agents. Here's a very interesting fact. There are studies which show that there is, if you think about, this is for people who actually think there is evolution is science, you know, and that people may not believe that, apparently. But according to the evolution, we don't need the kind of brains we have to survive on the savannas of Africa. Much smaller brain would have made us do just as well. Why did we have this bigger brain? Not to run away from the tiger. So there are actually, you know, interesting speculation studies, etc., showing that the reason human brain increased in size evolutionarily was because of the other human, not because of the tiger, not because of the ants, not because of the poisonous spiders. But because we had to deal with other humans. And in essence, we were modeling other humans' intentions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's ultimately what led to the increase in our brain size. So it's an interesting fact to keep in mind as to why we might need as big a brain as we have. Then what else do we have left? The actions that the agent does. You know, so we talked about the sensor. We talk about the environment itself. We can talk about the actions that the agent does. Okay? Are the actions that the agent does, are they deterministic? That means when the agent does this action, it knows exactly what would be the effect of doing this action. Okay? Or are they non-deterministic? That means after this action, the environment would be in one of all its possible states. Are stochastic, where in essence you are saying the environment is likely to be in these states with more probability than in these other states. Okay? Which is easier, harder, etc., etc. What is the easier problem? Deterministic actions is easier problem. Okay? Obviously, not having, so if you don't have good enough money, then you will buy effectors which are not particularly good. So they have, or if you become old, your hands are shaking. And so when you think you're trying to put a glass on top of another glass, you're shaking and the glass falls down. There's a good chance that it'll stay, but there's also a good chance that it'll fall down. Okay, so in that case, the old people have basically look at the same environment that you live in and think it's, hey man, it's stochastic, because I have cheap sensors, decaying sensors. Okay, I'm sorry, not sensors, effectors. Okay, whereas the guy who has very good sensors can exactly expect what the effect would be after they do this action. Now, there should be an interesting question. Let's see if he has that. Everything is yellow is harder, yes, yeah.
So if you're saying something that your requirement had everything in the yellow, would it actually be any good?
Meaning what? It's not that remember, this is all about the environment. I don't get to decide what my environment is. I just know whether the problem that I've been given is hard or easy. If I have very costly sensors that are perfect most of the time, and my environment is fully observable, and I have deterministic effectors, then my problem is easy. But if that's not the problem I'm given, I still have to solve it. So it's not that the agent gets to change the environment. However, we change the environment all the time. Okay? You know, how do you guys think you actually survived long enough to show up in this class? Given the number of ways you could have gotten electrocuted, burned yourself, hit yourself on the head with really pointy objects, etc. Why? Because your parents took pity on you, removed all of those things away from the home. So that when you didn't know enough about the environment was stabilized for you. One way you can change the environment, so on one hand I said the original environment that's given, you don't get to choose it. But you can stabilize the environment. Okay, here's the classic story, right? So I don't have good enough eyesight, and there are some books on this table. I'm not really sure whether books are there in the stable or not. I can get complete knowledge if he doesn't mind. What I would do is I'll just do like this so that all the books will fall on the ground. Now I know for sure. Okay? So I have changed the environment the environment originally I didn't know the state of it, but now after I did some actions it became a slightly different environment. And we stabilize the environment all the time for our kids. Okay, that's kind of interesting too. But we won't get into that right now. We'll assume that we'll deal with the environment that we have. And so it can basically become harder if it's yellow and easier if it is one of these things. Okay. Other things we will not get into too much, but let's see, actually we'll stop with that for the environment. There is a long slide here, which I won't go through because I've already described that with that cute picture. You can go and read it. So accessibility, deterministic, static versus dynamic environment. And then there are these other two things that the textbook talks about. One is episodic, which essentially says, is your performance going to be measured in different episodes, or is it going to be all or nothing at the end of your life for the agent? Okay, and it turns out that episodic is easier. Okay, that's why, you know, it's like if you don't like this course, you'll wait for the semester to be over, you'll take your grade and you start afresh next semester. Okay, whereas if we just said you get into one program at the end of which all of us together will give you a grade, that would be more non-episodic. Okay, and then discrete versus continuous, essentially, is the environment states, are they changing continuously or are they changing discretely from state 1 to state 2 to state 3? A different snapshot of time. Again, continuous is somewhat harder than discrete, to some extent. Okay. Now, you can talk about, and as I said, the agents, number of agents is sort of connected to the static versus dynamic. I already mentioned that earlier. And you could talk about for different kinds of scenarios, such as the solitaire, backgammon, internet shopping, taxi driver, agent, whether the environment is accessible, deterministic, episodic, static, discrete, etc. And it turns out that the easier problems will say yes for all the questions, and the harder problem will say no for all the questions. Okay, and it's not surprising. Most interesting problems will wind up having partially accessible, non-deterministic, or stochastic, non-episodic, and dynamic, continuous scenarios. But there are some problems which might have these accessible, deterministic, episodic, etc. And those problems are very interesting to solve too. So we'll start there and start off, go pieces towards the harder one. Okay. So now I talked about inputs, I talked about the performance metric, I talked about the types of environments. Finally, I'll talk about what's inside the agent. What's the architecture of the agent? Okay. Now, ultimately, all I want to say is an agent takes a sequence of percepts and converts it into an action. So it has a function which takes sequence of percepts and converts into an action. That's all it needs to do. Okay. So the simplest idea would be to write a big table. Big table says, if the percepts that you got till now are this, 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 and this, you do action A1. If it is this, 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 do action A2. Tables are good. You can put it in a database. It would be done. Okay, you should start with the dumb idea first. And it turns out that dumb idea is incredibly dumb, because in most cases, the number of distinct percept sequences is just too astronomically staggeringly big. So the table that you want would oftentimes have sizes that is, you know, lot larger than the number of atoms in the universe. Okay, and in fact, there's a nice little, you know, back of the envelope calculation showing the kind of table you would need for the taxi agent, making some reasonably easy assumptions, and you'll see it's a staggeringly large number of different percept sequences. Okay. Remember, when you're talking about percept sequences, what you wind up talking about is, suppose you are a taxi agent and you take a picture in front of you. So that might be, let's say, a 1024 by 1024 picture. Each pixel in that has an intensity. If the intensity of one pixel changes, now you are in a different state. So you can see how many different possible 1024 by 1024 by 256 intensity grade percepts you can wind up getting. And you're talking about the sequences over those. You die. Now, how do we solve the problem? We solve the problem at the minimum, you have to convert these pixels into some higher order feature. Okay? So you would have to say, well, from this picture, I can see there is a car coming at me, or there is a car behind me, or that the brake light of the car in front of me has just turned red, or that there's a huge big object right to the right side of me. This is the right side of me. Okay? These are the kinds of things you want. Now, this problem is called pixels to predicates problem, and if you are doing perception, that's exactly where you will spend all your time. Okay? But I will assume that you have done that. It's a huge assumption. But even after doing that, it turns out there's a lot more that still needs to be done. So I would say the simplest, the dumbest agent is something called table lookup agent. I just talked about that. It turns out it's like too incredibly dumb, because there's no way you can actually write it in terms of having that table. And then if you solve the pixels to predicates problem, which is basically the perception, and you know, getting higher order features out of it, then you go from there to what's called simple reflex agents, which in essence consider a large number of percept sequences as equivalent. So for example, from the point of view of the predicate, there is a car the car in front of me, its brake light has become red. That might correspond to literally millions of different photographs, where, you know, this one little pixel's intensity is different in this compared to this, but both of them, you look at it, you'll say, yeah, the light is on. So you have a huge reduction. You have basically made equivalence classes over a large number of perfect sequences. So that can bring you down such that you have a hope of writing a table. Okay, and then say, if you have a car in front of you which is about to brake, then the action should be you brake, or you turn away, or you do something to avoid getting killed. Okay, you take this for granted, but that step is important, going from what you are getting from the raw sensor to higher order pieces of information. Okay, if you get there, then you would talk about simple reflex agents. And the simple reflex agents sort of look like this. So remember, all agents will look like this. Essentially, if you forget about this, they have an environment, they're getting some sensory information, and they are doing some effects on the environment. And you're trying to figure out what's in this black box. Okay? In the table agent, the black box was a big table, except it won't fit. And in the simple reflex agent, all it has is looks at the sensor, there is a perception, pixels to predicates thing going on, which tries to say, there is a car in front of you, there is a car behind you, etc., etc. Okay? And when it does that, you have a bunch of rules which says that if this is the case in the current state, then do this action. And of course, ultimately, the final question that the agent always wants to ask is, what do I do now? What do I do now? Okay? And what do I do depends on what's the world right now according to your perceptive sequence, having filtered it through the higher order feature extraction, and then what are the condition action rules saying you should be doing. Now, this is important to understand, and oftentimes you can get away by writing these kinds of agents to solve a problem. There are two reasons why this is not good enough. To even do this, you would have already figured out how to do pixels to predicates. You would have done all the perception issues. So you still would have spent large number of lives to figure out how to do that, and then you at least have a simple reflex agent. Now, simple reflex agent is not general enough for two reasons, at least. Okay? One is that if you are in a world whose state is not fully observable, then if your sensor, raw sensor data itself is not in any sense complete description of the world, then how much our higher order processing you do on just that photograph, you really are not going to be able to get any features here on which you can make the decision. So in the case of the driving agent, here are two things, like, for example, blind spot. You know, those of you who are driving know that you may not be able to see the car that's in your blind spot. Okay, now we still drive. How do we drive? Because A, you could look behind. Furthermore, B, you have seen the traffic for the past couple of seconds. And based on that, you can say that since nobody has come into my lane, and the last time I looked, there was nobody in my lane, in the next lane, there's nobody still. This is the reasoning that you do every day when you actually travel. Otherwise, you would be traveling like this, you know, which causes certain amount of anxiety in other drivers, in other lanes, right? So you're trying to fill in blanks for the state information that's missing. Based on what? Based on your knowledge about how the world works. Why is it the case that the last time I looked, there was no car, 3 seconds later, if my rear view mirror says there's no car behind me still, then there's no car. Why is that the case? Why can't it be that? Why is it the case? Because I have expectations on the environment I live that cars don't magically appear out of nowhere. Right? Furthermore, if there was a car on your left-hand side lane, and then you took an exit, you don't need to check to see whether there is a car on your left-hand side line. Because your model of your world tells you that when you take an exit, you left that road behind. Right? These are things that you do just to get extra information about the environment that wasn't accessible from a single observation, because it's not a fully accessible environment. The moment the environment becomes even slightly partially accessible, you need to fill in by looking at a large number of previous states. In fact, think about something as simple as the guy in front of you braking. Suppose it turns out that this guy hasn't checked his brake lights for the last 10,000 years and the darn thing doesn't work. So it looks as non-red as ever. So does that mean that you get to go and rear-end them? No. As you see the distance reducing, you know, drastically, you have to realize, you know, that's not good. You know, and how do you realize that the distance is reducing? A single picture doesn't tell you that something has reduced. It's a sequence of observations. I'm getting closer, I'm getting closer, I'm getting closer. My God, there's something wrong. So I better start braking. Okay? So again, partial observability of the environment forces you into looking at modeling the environment. It's not enough any longer to just say, I look at the current state. I need a bunch of things which tell me some rudimentary model of the environment. The better my model is, the less I need to depend on the sensing and its imperfections. Okay? So you notice that now I'll have to have the set of states that the environment has gone through, and I need to have some understanding of when I'm not looking at the environment, how would it be evolving? What would be the sequence of states it would go through? And I should also have an understanding of what my actions would do. For example, this is where the taxi agent will say that if I do take an exit, then undo everything else I know about the previous road, because that doesn't count anymore. It was about the previous road. Okay? So just because of the partial observability and trying to get the state, recover the state, you would wind up having to take care of state, represent extra apart from just this and this, how the world evolves and what my actions do. These are called the models of the world, and you can represent the models of the world. This is where the knowledge representation comes. Previously, we had talked about why perception is important. To write the models of the world, you need some language in which you write the models of the world. You could either have black box models, which sort of say that if you are in this state and you do this action, these are the kinds of states that can happen, which is what we'll first look at, and that's where we'll do search-oriented reasoning. You could have logical models which talks about the incoming, the interior pieces of the state, okay, in terms of the features that it has, and how different actions will wind up changing different features. So it's sort of a more modular model. And then you can also have a probabilistic model where it's not deterministic. It's not that when you do this action, suddenly this thing becomes true, this thing becomes false. It might become true with some probability. It might become false with some probability. To have even simple reflex agents with models, you need to understand knowledge representation and search. Okay? I said there was two problems with the simple reflex agents. One is this business of filling up the holes in the observation. The other problem is what you want to do to write the condition action rules, you need to have some idea about what the agent is trying to do. If your agent is written for a single goal, that means you start it, it will go through a certain sequence of roads and get back to a certain place. Every time you start it, that's what it does. Then you can write condition action rules, because the goal is implicit. But if there are multiple goals and the goals can change, then this is hard to do, because you then have to compile the goals into the state and you have to write much larger number of condition action rules, where the condition also now depends on your goal. A better idea is, since you already have the model of the world, you can ask yourself one extra question, which will allow you to have more general architecture. So state how the world evolves, what my actions do, and since I have all this information, I can ask what's the world like now, which is basically based on the percept sequence and my ability to fill up the holes based on my domain model. Current percept as well as the previous states that I've already stored, And I can also ask, what will it be like if I do a particular action? This we actually put in previously mostly to undo the sequence of states. That you, because when you take an exit, the previous information is no longer valid. But now that that information is there, I can also ask, without actually doing anything in the environment, I can think, I can simulate, what would it be like if I do this action? If you can do that, then you can take goals, generalized goals, and using this simulation, figure out what must be the actions I should do so that I will eventually achieve this goal. Okay? So in terms of knowledge, the knowledge is the same. I just am asking one extra question, one extra piece of inference, which is what would the world be like if I do certain types of actions in certain sequence? And I have all the information I need to answer that question. And this reasoning essentially is search, planning, etc. So this is where you took the model of the world and you're simulating it in your head. Simulation is good because you're not doing it in the real world. So if one particular way, if I do this, there'll be a big crash. So maybe I shouldn't do this way. I'll go do something else. Okay? So in a way, you are, instead of having condition action rules, you are slowly making the condition action rules that are relevant for the goals that you have been given based on your ability to reason out. Okay? That ultimately is the more general architecture we'll talk about. Let me just show you this and we'll end the class today. So this is the same picture that you saw previously, right? And to be able to figure out how to represent state, how the world evolves, what my actions do, we need to talk about representation mechanisms. So we need to talk about logical reasoning or probabilistic reasoning or whatever your favorite reasoning formalism is. Representation formalism is. So you can either represent the logic, knowledge in deterministic mathematical logic, you can represent it in probabilistic logic, you can represent it in some network fashion. You have to talk about the languages. That's why we do knowledge representation. And then ask this question, we need to do reasoning. And we, in fact, even to answer this question, we need to do reasoning. Because you're using the knowledge to fill in the blanks as to what might be the state sequence that I did not observe. So this explains why we do search, planning, logical reasoning based in inference, which we will do in the semester. And these were there in the overview. But now I'm explaining to you why I do it. And this we will do because we need to do this. This is the representation part. And there is one other part that I didn't say. Who puts in all this knowledge into my agent? Is everything put in upfront or is pieces put in and the agent learns some of it by itself? If you are interested in making the agent more autonomous, such that it starts from some knowledge and increases its knowledge based on experience, then you need to be interested in learning. The learning winds up changing pretty much each of these boxes, each of the knowledge boxes. So that's why we do learning. So this sort of explains, this picture explains why you are doing what. And so when you have crisis of faith during the semester, go back to this picture, ask yourself, yeah, so why is the reason I'm doing this chapter? We'll come back next week and talk about one specific way, which is basically blind search with black box child models, which will allow us to write goal-based agents, which is another way of saying it is just understand A-star search. Okay, thanks.